Chapter 9. The weather had changed during the night. Ransom sat looking out from the edge of the forest in which he had slept on a flat sea where there were no other islands in view. He had waked a few minutes before and found himself lying alone in a close thicket of stems that were rather reed-like in character but stout as those of birch trees, and which carried an almost flat roof of thick foliage. From this there hung fruits as smooth and bright and round as hollyberries, some of which he ate. Then he found his way to open country near the skirts of the island, and looked about him. Neither Weston nor the lady was in sight, and he began walking in a leisurely fashion beside the sea. His bare feet sank a little into a carpet of saffron-coloured vegetation, which covered them with an aromatic dust. As he was looking down at this, he suddenly noticed something else. At first he thought it was a creature of more fantastic shape than he had yet seen on Perelandra. Its shape was not only fantastic, but hideous. Then he dropped on one knee to examine it. Finally he touched it, with reluctance. A moment later he drew back his hands like a man who had touched a snake. It was a damaged animal. It was, or had been, one of the brightly coloured frogs. But some accident had happened to it. The whole back had been ripped open in a sort of V-shaped gash, the point of the V being a little behind the head. Something had torn a widening wound backward, as we do in opening an envelope, along the trunk, and pulled it out so far behind the animal that the hoppers or hind legs had been almost torn off with it. They were so damaged that the frog could not leap. On Earth it would have been merely a nasty sight, but up to this moment Ransom had as yet seen nothing dead or spoiled in Perelandra, and it was like a blow in the face. It was like the first spasm of well-remembered pain, warning a man who had thought he was cured that his family have deceived him and he is dying after all. It was like the first lie from the mouth of a friend on whose truth one was willing to stake £1,000. It was irrevocable. The milk-warm wind blowing over the golden sea, the blues and silvers and greens of the floating garden, the sky itself, all these had become, in one instant, merely the illuminated margin of a book whose text was the struggling little horror at his feet. And he himself, in that same instant, had passed into a state of emotion which he could neither control nor understand. He told himself that a creature of that kind probably had very little sensation, but it did not much mend matters. It was not merely pity for pain that had suddenly changed the rhythm of his heartbeats. The thing was an intolerable obscenity which afflicted him with shame. It would have been better, or so he thought at that moment, for the whole universe never to have existed than for this one thing to have happened. Then he decided, in spite of his theoretical belief that it was an organism too low for much pain, that it had better be killed. He had neither boots nor stone nor stick. The frog proved remarkably hard to kill. When it was far too late to desist, he saw clearly that he had been a fool to make the attempt. Whatever its sufferings might be, he had certainly increased and not diminished them. But he had to go through with it. The job seemed to take nearly an hour. And when, at last, the mangled result was quite still, and he went down to the water's edge to wash, he was sick and shaken. It seems odd to say this of a man who had been on the Somme, but the architects tell us that nothing is great or small, save by position. At last he got up and resumed his walk. Next moment he started and looked at the ground again. He quickened his pace and then once more stopped and looked. He stood stock still and covered his face. He called aloud upon heaven to break the nightmare or to let him understand what was happening. A trail of mutilated frogs lay along the edge of the island. Picking his footsteps with care, he followed it. He counted 10, 15, 20, and the 21st brought him to a place where the wood came down to the water's edge. He went into the wood and came out on the other side. There he stopped dead and stared. Weston, still clothed but without his pith helmet, was standing about 30 feet away. And as Ransom watched, he was tearing a frog, quietly and almost surgically inserting his forefinger with its long, sharp nail under the skin behind the creature's head and ripping it open. Ransom had not noticed before that Weston had such remarkable nails. Then he finished the operation, threw the bleeding ruin away, and looked up. Their eyes met. If Ransom said nothing, it was because he could not speak. He saw a man who was certainly not ill, to judge from his easy stance and the powerful use he had just been making of his fingers. He saw a man who was certainly Western, to judge from his height and build and colouring and features. In that sense he was quite recognisable. But the terror was that he was also unrecognisable. He did not look like a sick man, but he looked very like a dead one. The face which he raised from torturing the frog had that terrible power which the face of a corpse sometimes has, of simply rebuffing every conceivable human attitude one can adopt towards it. The expressionless mouth, the unwinking stare of the eyes, something heavy and inorganic in the very folds of the cheeks, said clearly, "I have features as you have, but there is nothing in common between you and me." It was this that kept Ransom speechless. What could you say? What appeal or threat could have any meaning to that? And now, forcing its way up into consciousness, thrusting aside every mental habit and every longing not to believe, came the conviction that this, in fact, was not a man. That Weston's body was kept walking and undecaying in Perelandra by some wholly different kind of life, and that Weston himself was gone. It looked at Ransom in silence, and at last began to smile. We have all often spoken, Ransom himself had often spoken, of a devilish smile. Now he realized he had never taken the word seriously. The smile was not bitter, nor raging, nor, in an ordinary sense, sinister. It was not even mocking. It seemed to summon Ransom with a horrible naivete of welcome into the world of its own pleasures, as if all men were at one in those pleasures, as if they were the most natural thing in the world, and no dispute could ever have occurred about them. It was not furtive, nor ashamed. It had nothing of the conspirator in it. It did not defy goodness. It ignored it to the point of annihilation. Ransom perceived that he had never before seen anything but half-hearted and uneasy attempts at evil. This creature was whole-hearted. The extremity of its evil had passed beyond all struggle into some state which bore a horrible similarity to innocence. It was beyond vice, as the lady was beyond virtue. The stillness and the smiling lasted for perhaps 2 whole minutes, certainly not less. Then Ransom made to take a step towards the thing, with no very clear notion of what he would do when he reached it. He stumbled and fell. He had a curious difficulty in getting to his feet again, and when he got to them, he overbalanced and fell for the second time. Then there was a moment of darkness, filled with a noise of roaring express trains. After that, the golden sky and coloured waves returned, and he knew he was alone and recovering from a faint. As he lay there, still unable and perhaps unwilling to rise, it came into his mind that in certain old philosophers and poets he had read that the mere sight of the devils was one of the greatest among the torments of hell. It had seemed to him till now merely a quaint fancy. And yet, as he now saw, even the children know better. No child would have any difficulty in understanding that there might be a face the mere beholding of which was final calamity. The children, the poets, and the philosophers were right. As there is one face above all worlds merely to see which is irrevocable joy, so at the bottom of all worlds that face is waiting, whose sight alone is the misery from which none who beholds it can recover. And though there seemed to be, and indeed were, 1,000 roads by which a man could walk through the world, there was not a single one which did not lead, sooner or later, either to the beatific or the miserific vision. He himself had, of course, seen only a mask or faint adumbration of it. Even so, he was not quite sure that he would live. When he was able, he got up and set out to search for the thing. He must either try to prevent it from meeting the lady, or at least be present when they met. What he could do, he did not know, but it was clear beyond all evasion that this was what he had been sent for. Weston's body, travelling in a spaceship, had been the bridge by which something else had invaded Perelandra. Whether that supreme and original evil, whom in Mars they call the Bent One, or one of his lesser followers, made no difference. Ransom was all goose-flesh, and his knees kept getting in each other's way. It surprised him that he could experience so extreme a terror, and yet be walking and thinking, as men in war or sickness are surprised to find how much can be borne. It will drive us mad, it will kill us outright, we say. And then it happens, and we find ourselves neither mad nor dead, still held to the task. The weather changed. The plain on which he was walking swelled to a wave of land. The sky grew paler. It was soon rather primrose than gold. The sea grew darker, almost the colour of bronze. Soon the island was climbing considerable hills of water. Once or twice he had to sit down and rest. After several hours, for his progress was very slow, he suddenly saw two human figures on what was, for the moment, a skyline. Next moment they were out of sight as the country heaved up between them and him. It took about half an hour to reach them. Weston's body was standing, swaying and balancing itself to meet each change of the ground in a manner of which the real Weston would have been incapable. It was talking to the lady. And what surprised Ransom most was that she continued to listen to it without turning to welcome him, or even to comment on his arrival when he came and sat down beside her on the soft turf. "It is a great branching out," it was saying, "this making of story or poetry about things that might be but are not. If you shrink back from it, are you not drawing back from the fruit that is offered you?"
"It is not from the making a story that I shrink back, O stranger," she answered, "but from this one story that you have put into my head. I can make myself stories about my children or the king. I can make it that the fish fly and the land beasts swim. But if I try to make the story about living on the fixed island, I do not know how to make it about Maleldil. For if I make it that he has changed his command, that will not go. And if I make it that we are living there against his command, that is like making the sky all black, and the water so that we cannot drink it, and the air so that we cannot breathe it. But also, I do not see what is the pleasure of trying to make these things."
"To make you wiser, older," said Weston's body.
"Do you know for certain that it will do that?" she asked.
"Oh, yes, for certain," it replied. "That is how the women of my world have become so great and so beautiful."
"Do not listen to him," broke in Ransom. "Send him away. Do not hear what he says. Do not think of it."
She turned to Ransom for the first time. There had been some very slight change in her face since he had last seen her. It was not sad, nor deeply bewildered, but the hint of something precarious had increased. On the other hand, she was clearly pleased to see him, though surprised at his interruption. And her first words revealed that her failure to greet him at his arrival had resulted from her never having envisaged the possibility of a conversation between more than two speakers. And throughout the rest of their talk, her ignorance of the technique of general conversation gave a curious and disquieting quality to the whole scene. She had no notion of how to glance rapidly from one face to another, or to disentangle two remarks at once. Sometimes she listened wholly to Ransom, sometimes wholly to the other, but never to both.
"Why do you start speaking before this man has finished, Piebald?" she inquired. "How do they do in your world, when you are many, and more than two must often be together? Do they not talk in turns, or have you an art to understand even when all speak together? I am not old enough for that."
"I do not want you to hear him at all," said Ransom. "He is—and then he hesitated. Bad, liar, enemy, none of these words would as yet have any meaning for her. Racking his brains, he thought of their previous conversation about the great Eldil who had held on to the old good and refused the new one. Yes, that would be her only approach to the idea of badness. He was just about to speak, but it was too late. Weston's voice anticipated him.
"This Piebald," it said, "does not want you to hear me, because he wants to keep you young. He does not want you to go on to the new fruits that you have never tasted before."
"But how could he want to keep me younger?"
"Have you not seen already," said Weston's body, "that Piebald is one who always shrinks back from the wave that is coming towards us, and would like, if he could, to bring back the wave that is past? In the very first hour of his talking with you, did he not betray this? He did not know that all was new since Maleldil became a man, and that now all creatures with reason will be men. You had to teach him this. And when he had learned it, he did not welcome it. He was sorry that there would be no more of the old furry people. He would bring back that old world if he could. And when you asked him to teach you death, he would not. He wanted you to remain young, not to learn death. Was it not he who first put into your mind the very thought that it was possible not to desire the wave that Maleldil was rolling towards us, to shrink so much that you would cut off your arms and legs to prevent it coming?"
"You mean he is so young?"
"He is what in my world we call bad," said Weston's body. "One who rejects the fruit he is given for the sake of the fruit he expected, or the fruit he found last time."
"We must make him older, then," said the lady,
and though she did not look at Ransom, all the queen and mother in her were revealed to him, and he knew that she wished him and all things infinitely well. And he could do nothing. His weapon had been knocked out of his hand.
"And will you teach us death?"
said the lady to Weston's shape, where it stood above her. "Yes," it said. "It is for this that I came here, that you may have death in abundance. But you must be very courageous."
"Courageous? What is that?"
"It is what makes you swim on a day when the waves are so great and swift that something inside you bids you to stay on land."
"I know, and those are the best days of all for swimming."
"Yes, but to find death, and with death the real oldness and the strong beauty and the uttermost branching out, you must plunge into things greater than waves."
"Go on. Your words are like no other words that I have ever heard. They are like the bubble breaking on the tree. They make me think of... I do not know what they make me think of."
"I will speak greater words than these, but I must wait till you are older."
"Make me older?"
"Oh, lady, lady," broke in Ransom, "will not Maleldil make you older in his own time and his own way, and will not that be far better?" Weston's face did not turn in his direction, either at this point or at any other time during the conversation. But his voice, addressed wholly to the lady, answered Ransom's interruption. "You see," it said, "he himself, though he did not mean nor wish to do so, made you see a few days ago that Maleldil is beginning to teach you to walk by yourself, without holding you by the hand. That was the first branching out. When you came to know that, you were becoming really old. And since then, Maleldil has let you learn much, not from his own voice, but from mine. You are becoming your own. That is what Maleldil wants you to do. That is why he has let you be separated from the king, and even, in a way, from himself. His way of making you older is to make you make yourself older. And yet this piebald would have you sit still and wait for Maleldil to do it all."
"What must we do to Piebald to make him older?" said the lady.
"I do not think you can help him till you are older yourself," said the voice of Weston. "You cannot help anyone yet. You are as a tree without fruit."
"It is very true," said the lady. "Go on."
"Then listen," said Weston's body. "Have you understood that to wait for Maleldil's voice when Maleldil wishes you to walk on your own is a kind of disobedience?"
"I think I have."
"The wrong kind of obeying itself can be a disobeying." The lady thought for a few moments and then clapped her hands.
"I see," she said, "I see. Oh, how old you make me. Before now I have chased a beast for mirth, and it has understood and run away from me. If it had stood still and let me catch it, that would have been a sort of obeying, but not the best sort."
"You understand very well. When you are fully grown, you will be even wiser and more beautiful than the women of my own world. And you see that it might be so with Maleldil's biddings."
"I think I do not see quite clearly."
"Are you certain that he really wishes to be always obeyed?"
"How can we not obey what we love?"
"The beast that ran away loved you."
"I wonder," said the lady, "if that is the same. The beast knows very well when I mean it to run away and when I want it to come to me. But Maleldil has never said to us that any word or work of his was a jest. How could our beloved need to jest or frolic as we do? He is all a burning joy and a strength. It is like thinking that he needed sleep or food."
"Oh no, it would not be a jest. That is only a thing like it, not the thing itself. But could the taking away of your hand from his, the full growing up, the walking in your own way, could that ever be perfect unless you had, if only once, seemed to disobey him?"
"How could one seem to disobey?"
"By doing what he only seemed to forbid. There might be a commanding which he wished you to break."
"But if he told us we were to break it, then it would be no command. And if he did not, how should we know?"
"How wise you are growing, beautiful one," said Weston's mouth. "No, if he told you to break what he commanded, it would be no true command, as you have seen. For you are right, he makes no jests. A real disobeying, a real branching out, this is what he secretly longs for, secretly, because to tell you would spoil all.
I begin to wonder, said the lady after a pause, whether you are so much older than I. Surely what you are saying is like fruit with no taste. How can I step out of his will, save into something that cannot be wished? Shall I start trying not to love him, or the king, or the beasts? It would be like trying to walk on water, or swim through islands. Shall I try not to sleep, or to drink, or to laugh? I thought your words had a meaning, but now it seems they have none. To walk out of his will is to walk into nowhere.
That is true of all his commands, except one.
But can that one be different?
Nay, you see of yourself that it is different. These other commands of his, to love, to sleep, to fill this world with your children, you see for yourself that they are good, and they are the same in all worlds. But the command against living on the fixed island is not so. You have already learned that he gave no such command to my world, and you cannot see where the goodness of it is. No wonder. If it were really good, must he not have commanded it to all worlds alike? For how could Maleldil not command what was good? There is no good in it. Maleldil himself is showing you that, this moment, through your own reason. It is mere command. It is forbidding for the mere sake of forbidding.
But why?
In order that you may break it. What other reason can there be? It is not good. It is not the same for other worlds. It stands between you and all settled life, all command of your own days. Is not Maleldil showing you as plainly as he can that it was set up as a test? As a great wave you have to go over, that you may become really old, really separate from him?
But if this concerns me so deeply, why does he put none of this into my mind? It is all coming from you, stranger. There is no whisper even of the voice saying yes to your words.
But do you not see that there cannot be? He longs, oh, how greatly he longs, to see his creature become fully itself, to stand up in its own reason and its own courage, even against him. But how can he tell it to do this? That would spoil all. Whatever it did after that would only be one more step taken with him. This is the one thing of all things he desires in which he must have no finger. Do you think he is not weary of seeing nothing but himself in all that he has made? If that contented him, why should he create at all? To find the other, the thing whose will is no longer his, that is Maleldil's desire.
Oh, if I could but know this!
He must not tell you. He cannot tell you. The nearest he can come to telling you is to let some other creature tell it for him. And behold, he has done so. Is it for nothing or without his will that I have journeyed through deep heaven to teach you what he would have you know but must not teach you himself?
Lady, said Ransom, if I speak, will you hear me?
Oh, gladly, Piebald.
This man has said that the law against living on the fixed island is different from the other laws, because it is not the same for all worlds, and because we cannot see the goodness in it. And so far he says well. But then he says that it is thus different in order that you may disobey it. But there might be another reason.
Say it, Piebald.
I think he made one law of that kind in order that there might be obedience. In all these other matters, what you call obeying him is but doing what seems good in your own eyes also. Is love content with that? You do them, indeed, because they are his will, but not only because they are his will. Where can you taste the joy of obeying unless he bids you to do something for which his bidding is the only reason? When we spoke last, you said that if you told the beasts to walk on their heads, they would delight to do so. So I know that you understand well what I am saying.
Oh, brave Piebald, said the green lady, this is the best you have said yet. This makes me older far, yet it does not feel like the oldness this other is giving me. Oh, how well I see it. We cannot walk out of Maleldil's will, but he has given us a way to walk out of our will. And there could be no such way except a command like this, out of our own will. It is like passing out through the world's roof into deep heaven. All beyond is love himself. I knew there was joy in looking upon the fixed island and laying down all thought of ever living there, but I did not till now understand.
Her voice was radiant as she spoke, but then a shade of bewilderment crossed it.
Piebald, she said, if you are so young, as this other says, how do you know these things?
He says I am young, but I say not.
The voice of Weston's face spoke suddenly, and it was louder and deeper than before, and less like Weston's voice. I am older than he, it said, and he dare not deny it. Before the mothers of the mothers of his mother were conceived, I was already older than he could reckon. I have been with Maleldil in deep heaven, where he never came, and heard the eternal counsels. And in the order of creation I am greater than he, and before me he is of no account. Is it not so?
The corpse-like face did not even now turn towards him, but the speaker and the lady both seemed to wait for Ransom to reply. The falsehood which sprang to his mind died on his lips. In that air, even when truth seemed fatal, only truth would serve. Licking his lips and choking down a feeling of nausea, he answered, In our world, to be older is not always to be wiser.
Look on him, said Weston's body to the lady. Consider how white his cheeks have turned, and how his forehead is wet. You have not seen such things before. You will see them more often hereafter. It is what happens. It is the beginning of what happens to little creatures when they set themselves against great ones.
An exquisite thrill of fear travelled along Ransom's spine. What saved him was the face of the lady. Untouched by the evil so close to her, removed as it were 10 years' journey deep within the region of her own innocence, and by that innocence at once so protected and so endangered, she looked up at the standing death above her, puzzled indeed, but not beyond the bounds of cheerful curiosity, and said,
But he was right, stranger, about this forbidding. It is you who need to be made older. Can you not see?
I have always seen the whole whereof he sees but the half. It is most true that Maleldil has given you a way of walking out of your own will, but out of your deepest will.
And what is that?
Your deepest will, at present, is to obey him, to be always as you are now, only his beast or his very young child. The way out of that is hard. It was made hard that only the very great, the very wise, the very courageous should dare to walk in it, to go on out of this smallness in which you now live, through the dark wave of his forbidding, into the real life, deep life, with all its joy and splendour and hardness.
Listen, lady, said Ransom, there is something he is not telling you. All this that we are now talking has been talked before. The thing he wants you to try has been tried before. Long ago, when our world began, there was only one man and one woman in it, as you and the king are in this. And there once before he stood, as he stands now, talking to the woman. He had found her alone, as he has found you alone. And she listened, and did the thing Maleldil had forbidden her to do. But no joy and splendour came of it. What came of it I cannot tell you, because you have no image of it in your mind. But all love was troubled and made cold. And Maleldil's voice became hard to hear, so that wisdom grew little among them, and the woman was against the man, and the mother against the child. And when they looked to eat, there was no fruit on their trees, and hunting for food took all their time, so that their life became narrower, not wider.
He has hidden the half of what happened, said Weston's corpse-like mouth. Hardness came out of it, but also splendour. They made with their own hands mountains higher than your fixed island. They made for themselves floating islands greater than yours, which they could move at will through the ocean faster than any bird can fly. Because there was not always food enough, a woman could give the only fruit to her child or her husband and eat death instead, could give them all, as you in your little narrow life of playing and kissing and riding fishes have never done, nor shall do till you break the commandment. Because knowledge was harder to find, those few who found it became more beautiful and excelled their fellows as you excel the beasts, and thousands were striving for their love.
I think I will go to sleep now, said the lady quite suddenly.
Up to this point she had been listening to Weston's body with open mouth and wide eyes. But as he spoke of the women with the thousands of lovers she yawned, with the unconcealed and unpremeditated yawn of a young cat. Not yet, said the other. There is more. He has not told you that it was this breaking of the commandment which brought Maleldil to our world, and because of which he was made man. He dare not deny it.
Do you say this, Piebald? Asked the lady.
Ransom was sitting with his fingers locked so tightly that his knuckles were white. The unfairness of it all was wounding him like barbed wire. Unfair, unfair! How could Maleldil expect him to fight against this, to fight with every weapon taken from him, forbidden to lie, and yet brought to places where truth seemed fatal?
It was unfair. A sudden impulse of hot rebellion arose in him. A second later, doubt, like a huge wave, came breaking over him. How if the enemy were right after all? Felix peccatum adi. Even the church would tell him that good came of disobedience in the end. Yes, and it was true, too, that he, Ransom, was a timid creature, a man who shrank back from new and hard things. On which side, after all, did the temptation lie? Progress passed before his eyes in a great momentary vision. Cities, armies, tall ships and libraries and fame and the grandeur of poetry spurting like a fountain out of the labours and ambitions of men. Who could be certain that the creative evolution was not the deepest truth? From all sorts of secret crannies in his own mind, whose very existence he had never before suspected, something wild and heady and delicious began to rise, to pour itself towards the shape of Weston. "It is a spirit, it is a spirit," said this inner voice, "and you are only a man. It goes on from century to century, you are only a man."
"Do you say this, Piebald?" asked the lady a second time.
The spell was broken.
"I will tell you what I say," answered Ransom, jumping to his feet. "Of course good came of it. Is Maleldil a beast that we can stop his path, or a leaf that we can twist his shape? Whatever you do, he will make good of it. But not the good he had prepared for you if you had obeyed him. That is lost forever. The first king and first mother of our world did the forbidden thing, and he brought good of it in the end. But what they did was not good, and what they lost we have not seen. And there were some to whom no good came nor ever will come." He turned to the body of Weston. "You," he said, "tell her all. What good came to you? Do you rejoice that Maleldil became a man? Tell her of your joys, and of what profit you had when you made Maleldil and death acquainted." In the moment that followed this speech, two things happened that were utterly unlike terrestrial experience. The body that had been Weston's threw up its head and opened its mouth and gave a long, melancholy howl like a dog, and the lady lay down, wholly unconcerned, and closed her eyes and was instantly asleep. And while these two things were happening, the piece of ground on which the two men stood and the woman lay was rushing down a great hillside of water. Ransom kept his eyes fixed upon the enemy, but it took no notice of him. Its eyes moved like the eyes of a living man, but it was hard to be sure what it was looking at, or whether it really used the eyes as organs of vision at all. One got the impression of a force that cleverly kept the pupils of those eyes fixed in a suitable direction while the mouth talked, but which, for its own purpose, used wholly different modes of perception. The thing sat down close to the lady's head on the far side of her from Ransom, if you could call it sitting down. The body did not reach its squatting position by the normal movements of a man. It was more as if some external force manoeuvred it into the right position and then let it drop. It was impossible to point to any particular motion which was definitely non-human. Ransom had the sense of watching an imitation of living motions which had been very well studied and was technically correct, but somehow it lacked the master touch. And he was chilled with an inarticulate night-nursery horror of the thing he had to deal with, the managed corpse, the bogey, the unman. There was nothing to do but watch, to sit there, forever if need be, guarding the lady from the unman while their island climbed interminably over the Alps and Andes of burnished water. All three were very still. Beasts and birds came often and looked upon them. Hours later, the unman began to speak. It did not even look in Ransom's direction. Slowly and cumbrously, as if by some machinery that needed oiling, it made its mouth and lips pronounce his name. "Ransom," it said. "Well?" said Ransom.
"Nothing,"
said the unman. He shot an inquisitive glance at it. Was the creature mad? But it looked, as before, dead rather than mad, sitting there with the head bowed and the mouth a little open, and some yellow dust from the moss settled in the creases of its cheeks, and the legs crossed, tailor-wise, and the hands, with their long, metallic-looking nails, pressed flat together on the ground before it. He dismissed the problem from his mind and returned to his own uncomfortable thoughts.
"Ransom," it said again.
"What is it?" said Ransom sharply.
"Nothing,"
it answered. Again there was silence, And again, about a minute later, the horrible mouth said,
"Ransom."
This time he made no reply. Another minute, and it uttered his name again, and then, like a minute gun,
"Ransom! Ransom! Ransom!"
perhaps 100 times. "What the hell do you want?" he roared at last.
"Nothing," said the voice.
Next time he determined not to answer, but when it had called on him about 1,000 times, he found himself answering whether he would or no, and
"Nothing,"
came the reply. He taught himself to keep silent in the end. Not that the torture of resisting his impulse to speak was less than the torture of response, but because something within him rose up to combat the tormentor's assurance that he must yield in the end. If the attack had been of some more violent kind, it might have been easier to resist. What chilled and almost cowed him was the union of malice with something nearly childish. For temptation, for blasphemy, for a whole battery of horrors, he was in some sort prepared. But hardly for this petty, indefatigable nagging as of a nasty little boy at a preparatory school. Indeed, no imagined horror could have surpassed the sense which grew within him as the slow hours passed, that this creature was, by all human standards, inside out, its heart on the surface, and its shallowness at the heart. On the surface, great designs and an antagonism to heaven which involved the fate of worlds. But deep within, when every veil had been pierced, was there, after all, nothing but a black puerility, an aimless, empty spitefulness, content to sate itself with the tiniest cruelties, as love does not disdain the smallest kindness? What kept him steady, long after all possibility of thinking about something else had disappeared, was the decision that if he must hear either the word ransom or the word nothing 1,000,000 times, he would prefer the word ransom. And all the time the little jewel-coloured land went soaring up into the yellow firmament and hung there a moment and tilted its woods and went racing down into the warm, lustrous depths between the waves. And the lady lay sleeping with one arm bent beneath her head and her lips a little parted. Sleeping, assuredly, for her eyes were shut and her breathing regular, yet not looking quite like those who sleep in our world, for her face was full of expression and intelligence, and the limbs looked as if they were ready at any moment to leap up. And altogether she gave the impression that sleep was not a thing that happened to her, but an action which she performed. Then all at once it was night.
"Ransom! Ransom! Ransom! Ransom!"
went on the voice. And suddenly it crossed his mind that though he would sometime require sleep, the unman might not.